Today, property signs for the 28th of June 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at the catch-22 facing many first-time buyers, the shift to regional centres, and the disgraceful lack of support for small businesses. Plus, we consider the warnings represented by the Miami building collapse, the rise of fintech lending, and some more on the inflation debate. So let's get started. And by the way, today's show is supported by Ribbon Property Consultants. Australia's first home buyer schemes have come under scrutiny in the new report, with the moves to improve access to home ownership being described as a catch-22 by a leading expert. PRD, a major real estate firm, has released a report in response to recent rises in the price caps for those accessing government support under the scheme, which can allow first home buyers to pay just 5% on the new home build. According to PRD's chief economist, that can leave buyers in a dangerously large level of debt, having purchased their home before they were perhaps ready to. We want to raise awareness on what is in the current government schemes designed to increase access to home ownership, and if people are aware of the flip side of it in terms of how much debt they might be in after they have access to the incentives, the chief economist at PRD said. When it comes to government schemes, a lot of people look at it and think, great, the government is helping us to get into the property market and doing something about access to home ownership. They only see that side of the scheme, but this report raises awareness of the new price cap for how expensive a property you can buy for the different schemes and in different areas, and has some case studies. If you were a first home buyer in Lake Macquarie, for example, you're accessing a scheme and you've maxed out the property price that you can get under it, what sort of mortgage are you going to be able to get? We've played around with a few scenarios, and it's about highlighting that while people might be able to achieve home ownership and get the home they want quicker, the flip side is they have $500,000 in debt because they are doing it right now. And we're asking if people are aware of that. It's more about raising the awareness that there might be a catch-22 in these schemes and make sure that anyone who is thinking about accessing it thinks about the other side too. And elsewhere, more Australians are choosing to live in regional areas, a shift accelerated by COVID-19, according to a new report released by CBA and the Regional Australia Institute. It's the first RAI-CBA Regional Movers Index, and it shows population movements from Australian capital cities to regional areas rose by 7% from March 2020 to March 21, helping to drive net regional migration in the latest quarter 66% higher than a year earlier. The index reveals the regional areas with the largest annual share of capital city migration are coastal centres close to capital cities. Queensland Gold Coast at 11% and Sunshine Coast at 6%. Victoria's Greater Geelong at 4% and New South Wales Wollongong at 3% and Newcastle at 2%. The index also reveals that the five local government areas with the largest annual growth in capital city migration are Queensland's Noosa at 49% and Southern Downs at 44%. New South Wales Port Macquarie Hastings was at 38%, Tasmania's Launceston was at 34% and Queensland's Fraser Coast was at 26%. Capital cities in New South Wales and Victoria experienced the largest net migration outflows at 49.5% and 46.4% respectively. Regional New South Wales and regional Queensland are the main beneficiaries of the Sydney-Melbourne migration, followed by regional Victoria. The Greater Geelong area experienced a 10% annual growth and 9% quarterly growth to March 21, and the regional areas of Wollongong and Newcastle, New South Wales, experienced 8% and 7% year-on-year growth, respectively. Lawson's migration almost doubled in the March quarter, with migration increasing by 88%. CBA said, these figures show the strength and appeal of regional Australia and the important role it will continue to play in Australia's economic recovery. The index demonstrates how Australians formerly living in capital cities have embraced remote ways of working as an opportunity to experience what these areas have to offer, while those already in regional areas are finding reasons to stay. I'm optimistic about what this growth means for regional Australia, as far more people experience the livability of our regional areas and embrace the associated work-life balance and affordability, CBA said. And Regional Australia Institute CEO Liz Ritchie said, this new regional movers index will provide vital and timely data intelligence on emerging growth hotspots around the country, allowing governments, industry and communities to act more quickly on issues such as housing and infrastructure. The index shows it's not just people in our major cities who are realising the opportunities and value provided by regional living. People already living in our regions are increasingly choosing to stay rather than to head for the bright city lights, as Ritchie said. But let me make this point. That is in sharp contrast to the removal of banking services in a number of regional centres, including my own area down here in the Illawarra. The fact is that whilst the banks might be praising such regional moves, they're not backing it up with support for them in terms of financial service delivery. And that is what I discussed in my show just yesterday. As Alan Kohler highlighted in the New Daily, there are thousands of stories of family businesses in Victoria that have been forced to close or eat their savings to stay open, and there are about to be thousands more in Sydney with a lockdown starting up here. These families are not victims of nameless misfortunes or incompetence or even an economic downturn, but of government decisions designed to protect the community's health. In other words, they are being forced by our representatives to sacrifice their own family's wealth and happiness, and in many cases their health, so the rest of us don't get sick. Meanwhile, 66 large ASX-listed companies received $1.38 billion from the government in JobKeeper payments, about half of which went to companies that actually reported an increase in earnings. Harvey Norman received $22 million in JobKeeper payments, even though its profits doubled. Jerry Harvey has famously declared he won't be giving back any money, and the government is going to let him keep it. Of course, a lot of family businesses were kept going with JobKeeper as well, and a few of them would have got money they didn't need. But that's over now, and lockdowns are not. And that's because Australia's vaccination rate is pitiful, he says. Other countries are opening up and allowing businesses to operate because more than half of the population has had at least one dose. The Australian government has fully vaccinated 4.3% of the population, less than half the world's average, and a tenth of the UK and America. Yet no provision is being made to look after the families still being devastated by the lockdowns that are a direct result of the government's vaccination failure. Broad decisions have been made to end fiscal support based on budget targets and the obvious economic recovery, but decisions are still being made by governments to stop us going to certain businesses to protect community health, which have nothing to do with the health of the economy. And they shouldn't be seen as businesses, they're families, and they are being run over and left on the side of the road, victims of a bureaucratic hit and run. If even one family was ruined to protect the rest of us, even though the federal government could easily find the money to help them, it would be unacceptable. But there are thousands of them, and it's shameful. And now to the horrid Miami building collapse, which has left many questions. Engineers have started investigating the cause of the collapse, but it's too early to say what it is yet. Before the disaster, Champlain Towers South was already undergoing quality and safety inspections. City officials provided documents that revealed an engineer had warned in October 2018 that he discovered major structural damage to a concrete slab below the pool deck in a section of the South Towers. The engineer said in a structural survey report that waterproofing had failed below a pool deck and parking garage, which stopped water from draining off. The failed waterproofing is causing major structural damage to the concrete structural slab below these areas, the report said. Failure to replace the waterproofing in the near future will cause the extent of the concrete deterioration to expand exponentially. The report didn't warn of an imminent danger from the damage, and it is unclear if any of the damage observed was responsible for the collapse. But it did note the need for extensive and costly repairs to fix the systemic issues with the building. Separately, the building passed a roof inspection last Wednesday, according to the vice mayor. And Kenneth Drecker, an attorney for the building's condominium association, said the building also recently underwent a routine inspection, which is required once structures hit the 40-year mark. The apartment development was built in 1981. He said its findings were fairly typical of a building of its age, adding that there were no obvious signs of threats to its structural integrity. Surfside, a Miami suburb where the building collapsed, lies in a stretch of coastline adjacent to Hurricane Alley, an area of warm water in the Atlantic Ocean known for producing severe tropical storms. The region's inherent vulnerability is why Florida has some of the strictest building codes in the US. However, according to a report in the Miami Herald, most residential towers and family dwellings in this part of Miami County were built before those building codes were upgraded in the early 1990s. Shockingly, that's more than 700,000 properties. Some experts say the apartment's close proximity to the beach may have also contributed to its collapse. According to a 2020 research paper, the structure, which was built on reclaimed wetlands, had been sinking since the 1990s. Florida professor Simeon Wodisky, one of the paper's authors, told CNN that researchers found the building had some kind of unusual movement. He said such substance probably did not cause the collapse, but it could have been a contributing factor. The Miami building collapse should serve as an eye-opener to Australians, said Phil Dyer, the head of Small Builder Lobby Group Builders Collective of Australia. Although we don't know the exact cause of the tragedy, Dyer conceded, claims of cost-cutting by builders and greedy developers were common in the construction industry. For that reason, he said a similar collapse could happen here, adding, building practices haven't been very good in the last 25 years in Australia. It all comes back to money, he said. If a builder realised he was underquoted, he's going to cut every corner known to man to save money. In 2019, a shocking study into poor quality of apartment building found new blocks were plagued with defects, with at least one found in 85% of all buildings analysed. That report followed the emergency evacuation of residents in Mascot Towers in Sydney after cracks were discovered in the building. And in 2018, Sydney's Opal Towers was evacuated on Christmas Eve, and again 3 days later, after a large crack was found on level 10. The tower blocks are just a few examples of the apparent poor quality of some high-rise blocks in Australia. I don't want to fearmonger, but we do need more people to be alert, Mr. Dyer said. None of this, she'll be right, attitude. Next, could digitization change the lending landscape? Well, speaking at the Macquarie Technology Summit last week, Nathan Walsh, the chief executive of Thena, outlined his expectations of how increasing digitalization will change the lending industry. He believes fintechs and niche players will present a sizable challenge to the incumbent institutions who could be weighed down by legacy systems. Further, the ability to use personal data to compare products under open banking is anticipated to overpower the convenience that once came from using institutions as one-stop shops across financial products. From Thursday, the 1st of July, all non-major banks, billing societies and credit unions will be required to allow customers to share bank account, savings account, credit card and debit card data. Consumers will be free to share their data with third parties, such as money manager apps and investing fintechs. All banks will be required to provide home loan, personal loan and mortgage offset data from November. The final implementation phase, which will see banks obliged to share data across other products, including business finance, investment loans, lines of credit, overdrafts, and asset finance, is scheduled for February 2022. The pace of change outside the large legacy players is only growing faster. I think the legacy technology operations and operating models are just not well positioned to manage change at the pace required, Mr. Walsh said. I think what that leads to is real opportunity for specialist verticals in finance. It's never been easier for a consumer to actually work with best-in-class players in different components when you've got real-time payments to shift money, when you have the opportunity with things like open banking to really get an end-to-end view of your finances across providers. The advantages of going to a single provider to provide everything really diminishes if they're not providing a best-in-class solution in each of those spaces. For Mr. Walsh, open banking is an opportunity to remove friction from the home loan process, for example. Having access to data around income and expenses is expected to cut down dramatically the time frame and to simplify the application process for customers. The traditional legacy process for a consumer that was a very time-consuming, complex process. The real opportunity with digital, combined with digital access to data via open banking, is to make that substantially simpler, he said. And this is an industry that has used inertia somewhat as a superpower to charge excess spreads to consumers. There's a very large and sustained gap between what customers who've had a home loan for a number of years would look like versus those who got a new home loan. And today that's around 50 basis points for owner-occupiers and nearly that high for an investor. It translates into billions of dollars of excess interest being charged every year. Similarly, David Hyman, the CEO of Lendi, expects that lenders and brokers will have an opportunity to streamline the loan writing process to refine the digital experience and to deliver certainty. And meanwhile, Mr. Walsh has said he expects the direct digital channel will contribute to a greater share of new home loans, predicting that in the next 15 years, 30% of mortgages will be originated online, surging tenfold from the current 3%. Brokers are the majority of the market today, and I think that's for a reason. There's a lot of value that customers have in terms of helping people make choices around understanding the options out there and helping them through the process, and we don't see that changing, he said. What I do think is the case, though, is that there are a lot of scenarios where if you're doing a simple like-for-like refinance, if you're familiar with the process, I think there is a real comfort for consumers going direct and doing things digitally. So we do see the shift moving towards taking advantage of the simplicity of these channels, the access to data and those components, and that's whether there's a migration towards digital broking business as David's business, or whether that's a direct-to-lender. He said that mortgages has also felt impacts from the wave of digitalisation through COVID-19, with the direct channel benefiting. This has sort of been an unusual market because Australians are early adopters of digital technology and in so much of their lives, and will do a lot of research of home loans online, but then have typically gone back to an offline channel for the actual application and origination process, Mr. Walsh said. And so we've seen a really strong uptake and growth in terms of customers going directly to a lender to get the benefit of simplicity and speed and service. And finally, some more on the inflation question from the Fed. As the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted the economy last spring, core personal consumption expenditure, or PCE, in the US, inflation, fell dramatically. 1 year later, the opposite is occurring, with core PCE inflation rising above 3%. So the question is this recent upward inflation pressure transitory, representing pandemic-related price movements, or is this an indication of more persistent broad-based inflation trends? In other words, which price movements have directly related to pandemic disruptions? A potentially revealing indicator to address that question is the San Francisco Fed's inflationary sensitivity to COVID-19 series. The data shows contributions to core PCE inflation by their degree of sensitivity to the economic disruptions caused by the pandemic. The PCE price index is the inflation measure targeted by the Federal Open Market Committee. Core PCE removes food and energy products, which are historically very volatile and tend to cloud the underlying trend in inflation. So this inflation indicator divides the categories of core PCE inflation into components that are sensitive and insensitive to the pandemic. COVID-sensitive components include categories where either prices or quantities significantly changed at the onset of the pandemic between February and April 2020. COVID-insensitive components include all other core PCE categories. Price changes in the COVID-sensitive categories are more likely to be driven by disruptions directly related to the pandemic. Such disruptions include mandatory and voluntary social distancing measures, pandemic-related government policies, and supply chain bottlenecks. Hospital services, restaurant services, and physician services are among the largest of these categories. Price changes in the insensitive group are much less likely to be directly impacted by such factors. They include large categories such as housing services, pharmaceutical products, and charges for financial services. In February 2020, the 1.9% core PCE inflation rate was about equally divided between COVID-sensitive and COVID-insensitive components. The contribution of the sensitive components fell significantly by over 0.7 percentage points in April 2020. That, in fact, represents the majority of the 1 percentage point decline in core PCE inflation that month. The COVID-sensitive components have rebounded dramatically since bottoming out in April 2020. Its contribution to core PCE inflation increased to 1.1 percentage point in January, then surged to 2.4 percentage points in April 21. This component now contributes 1.7 percentage points more to core PCE inflation than it did on average between 2015 and 19. During the same time span, the contribution from the COVID-insensitive components to core PCE inflation was unchanged. The recent rise in inflation is therefore attributed to the same COVID-sensitive categories that declined the most during the onset of the pandemic last spring. In other words, this is the base effect. Assessing individual categories within the COVID-sensitive components shows that much of the increased inflation comes from two categories, healthcare services and used cars and trucks. Healthcare services is one of the largest components of core PCE inflation, representing close to 20% of core expenditures. In the contribution of healthcare services to core PCE inflation since 2015, in the 5 years preceding the pandemic, healthcare services contributed around 0.2 percentage points on average to core PCE inflation. The prices of healthcare services in the PCE price index are based on payments made by health insurers to providers such as physicians and hospitals. As the largest single player in healthcare providers, Medicare directly contributes to measurable changes in health service inflation. Furthermore, changes in Medicare prices tend to spill over directly into private prices, impacting overall healthcare services inflation. A number of pandemic-related legislative changes to Medicare payments have gone into effect over the past year. Those include a 20% add-on payment for COVID treatments, a temporary moratorium of the 2013 Medicare sequestration, 2% payment cuts, and a temporary 3.75% increase in payments to physicians. Overall, these factors have led to a 0.6 percentage points increase in the contribution of healthcare services. That's triple its average contribution between 2015 and 19. And importantly, these payment changes are temporary, are unexpected to either roll off or reverse by early 2022. Thus, what is now a boost to inflation coming from healthcare services is likely to be a drag by next year. And also, the contribution of used autos and trucks to core PCE inflation since 2015 is significant. Owing to this category's very stable prices, its contribution hovered close to zero between 2015 and 2019. But in April 2020, prices became strikingly volatile. The contribution declined, down 0.1 percentage point, but then reversed course and began surging upwards. A steady increase in the demand for cars in tandem with a shortage of semiconductors, a key production input for new cars, led to severe upward price pressure for used vehicles. Overall, the contribution of used vehicles to core PCE inflation has surged to 0.5 percentage points. That's significantly higher than its pre-pandemic contribution. Now, it remains unclear how long car production will remain constrained. However, a consensus of market participants expects some easing by the second half of 2021. And so they conclude that the recent sharp increase in measured inflation is unlikely to persist beyond this year. The increase is being driven by spending categories where prices fell the most last spring. And furthermore, much of the surge in the COVID-sensitive component is due to healthcare services and used vehicles, in which evidence suggests recent price increases will be temporary. The remaining COVID-sensitive categories include many products where prices increased, likely for temporary reasons. For example, a shift in demand towards low-risk products boosted the prices of products that were used at home, such as furniture and household appliances. Prices for these types of products are not likely to keep increasing at such a rapid pace as the economy returns to pre-pandemic conditions. Still, some risks for higher inflation do exist. More recently, the prices of high-risk economic activities, such as air travel and hotels, have risen as the economy begins to reopen. This could push inflation higher as demand continues to shift back to services more broadly. And furthermore, supply chain bottlenecks could last longer than anticipated, pushing prices even higher for some products. But more generally, the recent high inflation episode risks raising longer-run inflation expectations among businesses, altering current and future price-setting behaviour. These upward pressures could offset some of the expected pricing effects when the temporary inflation in healthcare services, used vehicles and other COVID-sensitive products begin to ease. So we'll have to wait and see, but once again, this underscores that maybe the inflationary blips that we're seeing are fundamentally temporary. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.